The first thing I want to say is correction. I think stated offhand in the data tree is transcendental, but roughly don't have that. An open problem, in fact, it's only known to be algebraic. I mean, to be not rational, but possibly algebraic, i.e. irrational. So zeta 3 is a theorem of a priori that it's irrational, but it's an open problem to decide whether or not it's transcendental. So I think everyone thinks it's transcendental. So it is transcendental, but we don't know that. What I'll do today is describe a presentation for the space M2 gamma 0 of n of modular symbols, which makes that space completely computable. And I did a lot of this already as far as laying the groundwork, or the groundwork goes, but now I'll actually show you what the presentation is. And then I'll show you a whole bunch of examples in stage where you see actual computation of the space for various n and computing things about it, okay? So it's going to take me a second to turn this projector on, unfortunately, but you can look at the notes while I do that. So when I go very quickly to the first page or two, you'll be prepared to understand everything I see. So if you look at theorem 334, I'm going to prove most of that theorem for you right now. And it describes a module that's canonically isomorphic to M2 gamma 0 of n, but for which sort of clear from the definition that the thing can be computed. So here's how it works. So recall last time that we fixed coset representatives R0 through Rm for gamma 0 of n in SL2z, for the cosets of gamma 0 of n in SL2z. These are coset reps. And then to each of these R sub I, we associated a specific element of M2 gamma 0 of n, namely, just what you get by applying Ri to the special modular symbol 0 infinity. And then very quickly at the end of class last time, I proved that that the images of 0 infinity under a collection of coset representatives, well, it gives you a whole bunch of elements of M2 gamma 0 of n. In fact, it generates. And just a quick reminder, M2 gamma 0 of n is the quotient of the free abelian group on symbols alpha beta, where alpha and beta run through Q1 and Q. Modulo a whole bunch of relations, namely alpha beta plus beta gamma plus gamma alpha. You want that to be zero. You also require that gamma x is equal to x for all gamma in gamma zero of n, and all x in, it suffices to take all symbols like this. So you take the quotient by the subgroup and also by any quotient. So it's a potentially big looking object, an abelian group, torsion free, but you've quotient out by a lot of relations, And as I proved last time using continued fractions, you can write any element in here as a linear combination of elements of this form. And now, for each of these r sub I, as I goes from 0 to m, consider symbols, or many symbols, square brackets ri prime, and you have exactly m plus one of these symbols, and I'll show you a bunch of relations that their image in here, in m2 gamma 0 n satisfy, and if you quotient out by those relations, then you get something isomorphic to m2 gamma 0 of n. Perfect. I'm sure this works. Good. Okay. So you have symbols ri prime for I equals 0 up through m. Here m is, of course, just the index of gamma 0 of n inside of SL2z. And just consider, well, let's let capital M be the free abelian group on the m plus 1 symbols, square brackets ri prime, as I goes from 0 to n, modulo a bunch of relations, and modulo torsion. The relations are, so where the relations are following. So there's three term relations. The two term relations are ri prime plus ri prime sigma. Let's see. Here sigma is equal to 0 minus 1, 1, 0. And define another matrix tau, which is equal to 1 minus 1, 1, 0. And notice that at least in PSL2Z, this has order 2 and this has order 3. Tau is order 3. So here are the two term relations. You have exactly m plus 1 of them, one for each of the i's. And it just says that if you act by sigma on this, you get that. And the way that this action works is, this is really the same thing as ri times sigma prime. And by this I mean this ri times sigma, well, just consider the coset that this belongs to, that will have a representative r sub j, and that's what symbol this is. Okay? So sigma acts on the collection of these Benning symbols via just permuting around the cosets. So those are the two-term relations. The three-term relations are very similar. Ri prime plus ri tau prime plus ri tau squared prime. So that's another relation. So you're quotienting out by these, so you want them to be zero. So if you take this, so here's the theorem. If you let M be this free abelian group, modulo those relations, and modulo any torsion, then you have a well-defined homomorphism to M2 gamma 0 of N. And it's in fact an isomorphism, and it's the map defined by ri prime goes to ri, which is by definition ri applied to 0 and infinity. So to compute m2 gamma 0 of n, all you have to do is write down the free abelian group on m plus 1 symbols modulo this completely explicit list of two m plus 1 relations, take the quotient, which is a purely a matter of linear algebra, and you'll get this object, and it's isomorphic to that object. So you'll get an explicit list of symbols like this, and you know all the relations, they just come from what you did over here. Okay, now, so far what have I proved? Well, I proved that if there were enough here, it would be surjective. I proved that every element of M2 gamma 0 of n is in the image of this homomorphism. But I haven't proved even that this map is well-defined, and I haven't proved that it's injective. So I'll prove right now that it's well-defined. So to prove that this is well-defined means to show that each of the relations goes to zero under this map. So I have to show you that Ri prime plus Ri sigma prime, when you consider the two modular symbols that you get from these, that their sum is zero in this group right here. So I'll show you that. So let's take the two-term relations first. This one's particularly easy. What does Ri prime map to? Well, it maps to Ri 0 infinity. And Ri sigma prime maps to Ri sigma 0 infinity. And now just applying the definitions, Ri is an Ri of 0 comma Ri of infinity. So the first term is. The second term is Ri of sigma of 0. What is Ri of sigma of 0? Okay, what is sigma of 0? Infinity. So Ri of sigma of 0 is Ri of infinity. What about sigma of infinity? 0. Right. Ri of 0. And one of the relations that modular symbols satisfy is that alpha beta plus beta alpha is equal to 0. That just comes from this three-term relation, the fact that there's no torsion, and setting gamma equal to alpha. Okay? So this is equal to 0. So indeed, the two-term relations do all map to 0 under this map. And likewise, the three-term relations, if you just write down exactly the sort of thing we just did, except with tau instead of sigma, you end up with 0 infinity plus, I think, infinity 1 plus 1, 0. So using this relation, you get that the three-term relations also map to 0. And that implies that this map that I've written down here is, in fact, makes sense. It's well-defined. I mean, it wasn't a problem to write down a homomorphism before quotienting out, but now we know we have a homomorphism after quotienting out. The one thing I haven't shown you now is that it's an isomorphism. It's surjective, it's well-defined, but I haven't shown that it's an isomorphism. Maybe there are additional relations that are not amongst the two-term and three-term relations that I've listed there. In fact, that's not the case. The only way I've seen to prove that is to, without bringing in the whole Eichler-Shamir cohomology description of modular forms, is to write down a complex and then figure out exactly what the homology of the complex is. So Manning does that in his paper, and I've recopied and explained what he did in some notes I wrote for a class a couple of years ago, but I won't be describing that in detail here. But I've shown you everything except the fact that this map is injective. And incidentally, in any particular case, you would observe that it's injective if you computed this, because you know the dimension of M2 gamma 0, and there's a nice formula for it, which is easy to program. So if you compute this, and you find that its rank is the same as the rank of M2 gamma 0, then you know for a fact that you've quotient out by all relations. So in practice, you don't need a proof that the map is injective, but in fact, there's such a proof. Okay, so I've now completely explained to you modulo this one little injectivity issue. I've given you a fairly simple object, a free abelian group on some symbols, modulo some relations. And if you compute that thing, you get something isomorphic to M2 gamma 0 of n. M2 gamma 0 of n is dual to modular forms. So if you can compute this, then you can compute that, and hence you can almost compute modular forms. You need a little bit more to do it, but I'll show you what more you need. Okay, now I'm going to show you some examples of actually computing M2 gamma 0 of n and using SAGE. By the way, what in Sage, it doesn't, by default, compute over the integers. Sorry, there should have been a Z here. It computes over the rationals, just because the linear algebra is a little easier to implement, and it's more efficient. So what you end up getting is M2 gamma 0 and tensored with Q. But for our purposes, that's perfectly fine, since we're really interested in modular forms. And modular forms from a vector space over C, certainly tensoring something defined over Z that is dual to modular forms up to Q is a prime number. Okay, so let me show you some examples of computing M2 gamma 0 then explicitly. Then after I do that, I'll tell you about Hecke operators on modular symbols spaces. Okay, Alex, do you think I could close some of the blinds? Maybe. Thanks. Okay, so can everybody see the screen? Okay, so in Sage, to compute a space of modular symbols, you use the command modular symbols, not surprisingly. And what this computes is M2 gamma 0 then tensored with Q. So a Q vector space that you get from the other thing by just taking the same sort of basis and getting it over Q. So the simplest one, I guess, would be with level 1 and weight 2. The default weight is 2, so I can just put level 1. And you get a space of dimension 0. See, there's a little dimension 0 right here. Whoops. So it says dimension 0. So that just says that M2 gamma 0 1 has dimension 0. That's something you can explicitly check if you're to go through this definition you find, or this construction you'd find that the dimension 0. We could try a more complicated one. So this is for n equals 2. And here, the dimension is 1. So there are a couple of commands that will allow you to sort of see why the dimension is 1, what the relations are, and so on. So one command, manin generators, it outputs a list of manin symbols. And I'll lift the board for a second, or lift the screen for a second. It outputs a list of these symbols that generate. So it's really, it's outputting these. And then, the notation is the following. So the R sub I are right coset representatives, but the right cosets of gamma 0 of n in SL2z correspond to the elements of P1 of z mod nz. So what it's giving here are the elements of P1 of z mod nz, where n equals 2. So those are the points of the projective line over F2, or over Z mod 2Z. Notice there are, in fact, 2 plus 1, or 3 of those points. So that's one example. Also, there's another command, manin basis, which gives a subset of the manin symbols, a list of indices into this list of generators. So in particular, that 1 means 1, 0. It's a zero-based list, and this gives a subset of these so that every other one can be written in terms of this subset using the relations. And the way that that's arrived at is you write down a matrix coming from the two-term and three-term relations. You compute its reduced row echelon form using sparse Gauss elimination. You can do the two-term relations very efficiently. But using sparse Gauss elimination, you find the reduced row echelon form essentially of a matrix that has those two-term and three-term relations as its rows. And then from that, you can read off from the pivot columns and the non-pivot columns, you can read off a subset of the generators so that everything else can be written in terms of that subset. All right, let me show you a more interesting example. We'll try level 11. Now the dimension is 3, there will be, how many generators are we going to have? So these correspond to the elements of P1 of Z mod 11Z. How big is that set? 12, right? And there they are, 12 different generators. Then you mod out by the two-term and three-term relations, by any torsion, working over Q, and every other, at least over Q, every generator will be writable in terms of some subset of the generators, modulo the relations, and that subset is the generator here, and then whatever the ninth and tenth ones are. I can just enlist it like this. Manin generators, so I for I in Manin basis. So this will just list three of the above. Oops, what did I do? Generators, thank you. So that lists three. Every one of these 12 Manin symbols can be written modulo the relations in terms of these three. So the space M2 gamma 0 of 11, it's a three-dimensional space, and I've written down explicitly a basis for it. It's the three modular symbols that correspond to these three elements of P1 of Z mod 11Z, and given any expression at all involving modular symbols, I can rewrite it. There's some way of writing each of these in terms of these. I can rewrite any expression involving modular symbols first using the continued fractions thing I mentioned last time in terms of these, and then using, I'll show you in a second, Manin relations. Manin symbol, let's see, where is it? There's a command that gives each of the generators in terms of the basis. Gens to basis, thank you very much. Gens to basis. Okay, so what this gives is how to write each of the 12 generating Manin symbols in terms of our subset of three basis Manin symbols. That's what's listed here. So if you had some arbitrary modular symbol, you could write it in terms of modular symbols of this form right here, where you have various R sub i's and, of course, various multiplicities in which they occur. For each of these R sub i's, there's a corresponding element of P1 of Z mod 11Z, you know, something in this list right here. And then each element of that list, you can write in terms of three of the elements in that list using this list of relations. For example, the first, the zeroth one is minus our first generator, and so on. Okay? And you can do this for very, very large spaces. It's reasonable to do calculations like this for n up to, at least computing a presentation like this, it's quite reasonable to do it for, say, n up to 150,000. That's not out of the question. And you can certainly go a little farther if you try hard and have a lot of memory. 2006 probably won't completely bring this computer to its knees. So it took 2 seconds to compute I put the two and three term relations for level 2006 in a matrix, did sparse Gauss elimination, and it wrote everything in terms of these. Well, I can do just like I did above, in terms of some subset of 541 of those symbols. And there are quite a lot of symbols, m.manin, generators. You start with 3,240 different elements of P1 of Z mod 2006Z, and you quotient out by lots of relations, you end up with 541, that you can write everything in terms of 541 of those original 3,240. And of course, you can get explicitly the expression of anything in terms of the basis of 541 of them. So for example, whatever the 20th one is, that's how you write it in terms of a basis. So notice that it's pretty sparse in this case, and then there's a couple of entries that occur. Okay, so in some sense, we've now explicitly computed this thing. Yes, that need not always be the case, but in fact it is the case here. In general, they could be rationals. It's just you have this huge sparse matrix with every entry is, except possibly when you have fixed points for tau or sigma, the entries really, they're all one. There's two or three non-zero entries per row. The entries are all, the coefficients are all one. Possibly you have a two, a one and a two. Some things can happen like that. But basically the entries are all. Actually, if Ri were fixed by tau, then you just have three in that one row. So, yeah, so you'll have three different ones, or you'll have a three, in which case you would throw away that that symbol completely. So you have a very simple matrix of essentially ones and odd. And when you compute its echelon form, not surprisingly, the result isn't going to be that complicated. Actually, I did compute over Q the presentations for M2 gamma 0 of n for every n up to 500, and then I did the same thing over Z, and I got exactly the same presentations up to 500. So I don't know why that is. It's kind of a Victor Miller-ish phenomenon that occurs, and I don't completely understand it. I was a little surprised by that. I did that when I was making these notes. There's another nice thing you can do, which is, I think if you say set mod sim print mode, there's a function that allows you to, well, okay, so let me do a few simple things first. So we have m, you can actually say m.basis, and it gives you a basis for the space of modular symbols of level 11, and they're written as Manning symbols. They're given by giving the lower two entries of coset representatives. But you can say set print, or set mod sim print mode, and you can change it to mod sim, and instead of them printing out, to modular, instead of having them print out as Manning symbols, they print as modular symbols, okay? Which is nice. So for level 11, thinking back to the original definition of modular symbols I gave on Monday, a basis is the modular symbol from infinity to zero, a modular symbol from minus 1/8 to zero, and a modular symbol from minus 1/9 to zero. Okay. You can also take an arbitrary specific modular symbol, such as 1/17 to, infinity, and it will tell you what that is equal to in terms of our basis. Okay, so it's sort of basic things that you need to do to compute with such an object. But the implementation of this, the underlying implementation of this, all involves just computing that right there. Of course, you can do arithmetic, like if you have another symbol, minus 45 over something big, 1 over 121, now you can add them together and it gives you apparently nothing, not much different here. Huh. I guess that second one better be zero, and indeed it is. I'm just sort of playing around here, but it's the sort of thing you can do. So you can find out what anything's equal to. Okay. And we can, you can make more complicated spaces, say 39 m.basis. We're going to get 9 things out. So this is a basis of modular symbols of level 39. So exactly this calculation where you have these generators, modulations, you have these explicit symbols, it's the sort of thing that even 40, 45 years ago people would do, possibly by hand in some cases, and work very hard just to get something like this. And now you can do it quite, very quickly on a computer. 389. So you get big basis there. And okay, so that's the first thing. I've now written down explicitly a space that is essentially this is very, very closely related to modular forms of weight 2 and level n. And now, how do you get to the relation between the two? So the key to that is to use Pekka operators. And if you look at page 51 of the notes, you'll find the definition of Pekka operators on modular symbols. And it's exactly the same as the definition of PEC operators on modular forms that I gave before. You have a modular symbol alpha beta, TP axonet by summing over the matrices that are the Hermite normal forms of lattices of index P inside of Z cross E, which explicitly, if P is a prime, which is the thing that's given in the notes, a specific list of such matrices is P001. And then 1R0P, and we're going to stick alpha beta here, as R goes from 0 up to P minus 1. So this gives a definition of the HEC operators on modular symbols. And it's pretty easy to see directly that with this definition of HEC operators, if you define an integration pairing between modular forms and modular symbols as follows. Well, here F is a function, a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. This F should be specifically an element of S2 gamma 0 of n. And alpha beta is supposed to be a modular symbol in M2 gamma 0 of n. Well, a natural way to pair these two up to a constant that I might not remember correctly, so I'll just put star, well, up to a question mark for the constant, but it's just integral from alpha to beta of f of z dz. I think the constant's minus 2 pi I, the right choice of constant to make for various to normalize things nicely. So, you know, the mysterious integration pairing I mentioned before, it's simply, well, you have two points, say cusp alpha and beta, you have a function on the upper half plane, you integrate along a path from alpha to beta. And the fact that f is a holomorphic function means that it doesn't matter which path you integrate along. So you have it. Modular symbols are defined in, I mean, I define them formally for you, but they're defined in exactly the right way so that this pairing is well defined. And moreover, if you restrict to cuspidal modular symbols, which I defined for you before, then you get a non-degenerate pairing, which is perfect if you tensor the cuspidal modular symbols up with R. That is to say that the non-degenerate pairing of each thing is an R vector space of the same dimension, or a C vector space of the same dimension, if you give us a structure of C vector space. So another fact about modular symbols is that the HEC operators also behave well with respect to this pairing. It's not surprising. If you sum over these P plus 1 matrices that I've acted on the modular symbol with here, if you sum over their action on F, then you get the action of the HEC operator TP on F. So this all the definitions are set up exactly so that TP, and now I'll write the action of F on the right of TP, so it's really the same. So, TP alpha beta, this is equal to pairing F with TP acting on alpha beta. So modular symbols are really defined exactly so that this works out and so that this pairing is well defined. By well defined, replace alpha beta by an equivalent modular symbol, module all the relations that I gave, you're supposed to get an equal pairing. And that just amounts to basic facts about, or like the standard facts about complex analysis, about integrating a holomorphic function around a closed loop where it doesn't have any bad behavior inside, gives you zero. So these HEC operators, the fact that you have this HEC equivariance of this pairing tells you that a week ago when I talked about HEC operators acting on level 1 modular forms, and you just looked at the definition of the HEC operator on Q expansions, you found that if you had an eigenvector for the HEC operators, then if you normalized it so the coefficient of Q is 1, then the the nth coefficient of the Q expansion is exactly the Hecke, is exactly the eigenvalue of the nth Hecke operator on that modular form. So you can completely, if you have an eigenform, you can recover its Q expansion just from the eigenvalues of the Hecke operators acting on that modular form. So what you do here is, well, notice, imagine that F were an eigenvector for all the Hecke operators. Then FTP would be APF. But on the other hand, you can just move this to the other side, and you'd find that this pairing in the other way would also be AP times the original thing, just because you can do it on either side. But on this side, you get something that you can really compute explicitly. So the upshot of what I'm saying is that if you find a modular symbol, or possibly you have to go up to a bigger field to find some linear combination of modular symbols that's an eigenvector for the Hecke operators, then you can use that to sort of know that there exists a modular form with the same system of eigenvalues, even though you don't actually know the modular form. You know it has to be there. And then what you do is you just figure out what the eigenvalues are, and they are the coefficients of the Q expansion of the modular form. So therefore, you know the modular form. So everything I just said, I'll talk about more on Monday, but it's just to motivate that you might want to be able to compute Hecke operators on modular symbols. Computing Hecke operators on modular symbols allows you, because of this nice behavior of the pairing, to get information about modular forms. Okay, so this is also enough to actually compute Hecke operators on modular symbols, just the definition. Because after all, I showed you in this example, or in various examples, if you have a modular symbol, you can just, you know, you can do something like, you know, if you have any modular symbol at all, or any linear combination of these things, I'm just making up something completely random. Whoa, that's not good. Oh no. Better make up something that's a little smaller. That's a bug though, that shouldn't happen. So, I've taken this random modular symbol and I've written in terms of my basis. So you can do that, and you could just run through your basis of modular symbols, which was listed before, and hit each one with a Hecke operator, and then give back some huge sum of modular symbols, and then use continued fractions to shrink, you know, to write each of those things in terms of write cosets, and then those you know how to write in terms of generating modular symbols. It's incredibly tedious and slow to do that, but you could do that. Just from the definition, there's enough information to compute Hecke operators on spaces of modular symbols, from what I showed you. Fortunately, Loïc Morel, in much more generality than just this, did a PhD, and one of the main things he did in his PhD, and also in some subsequent work at the Institute for Experimental Mathematics, is he gave a description of the action of Hecke operators directly on Manin symbols. So again, behind the projector, I've given a presentation for modular forms, a presentation for modular symbols in terms of a free abelian group on n plus one symbols, modulo simulations. It would be nice if you could directly compute Hecke operators on here, and indeed you can. And that's how it's done these days. So, not sure exactly how much to tell you, but there's an explicit, fairly easy to compute list of matrices similar to this list of matrices, but if you act on a modular symbol, a Manin symbol, Ri, we have is a Tp acting on this is equal to the sum over matrices G in some explicit, fairly easy to compute set S of P of Ri G. So in doing this calculation, you completely avoid ever having to convert anything into modular symbols using, you don't have to use continuing fractions, none of that's involved. Moreover, an amusing fact about the set S of P is the level isn't involved at all. You compute it once and for all, the level n just has nothing to do with it. That's not too surprising because the definition of the Hecke operators also has nothing to do with the level. Though in everything I'm saying, P is assumed to not divide the level. You have to modify things just a little bit when P divides the level. But there's a set SOP like this. The description's given in the notes. You can read a complete proof that it works in Kimona's book, Algorithms for Modular Elliptic Curves. The proof is about a page, and it's adapted from what Loic Morel does, I think. Loic gives a general criterion for a set to work for computing Heck operators, and he gives a whole bunch of different families of sets of elements that will work for computing Heck operators. What Kimona does is just give some sort of very small set that he can prove directly works. So let me demonstrate this. So if we define a space of modular symbols, such as one of, say, level, 11, then we can compute Heck operators on it. So you just say m.heck_operator, and then you give a number, say 2, and you get t2. And there it is. That's extremely unimpressive. I don't know if you can see it. I hope you're not impressed. So are you very impressed with my computation of the second Heck operator? If you say matrix, it actually gives the matrix. And now it actually doesn't work. But this is relative to the basis, m dot basis. This is the Heck operator T2, completely explicitly. And you can compute other Heck operators. For example, the 97th Heck operator. And there's the matrix of the 97th Heck operator. And notice that T97 and T2 commute. It's one of the basic facts about Heck operators, they all commute. So, now, the real interesting thing is to figure out what the systems of eigenvalues are for the Heck operators. We've written down a module, the space of modular symbols. It's this finite rank thing. It's equipped with an action of a bunch of Heck operators. These Heck operators commute with one another. So you can basically have a module over a commutative ring. And it's a finite rank module, so you can ask to decompose this module as a direct sum of irreducibles, at least after tensoring so that you're over a field, or possibly leaving out some Heck operators so that you have a... Well, if you take the Heck operators T sub n with n coprime to the level, it's a fact that the resulting ring they generate, every element of that ring is diagonalizable. So you can ask to simultaneously diagonalize their action. So it's commuting diagonalizable linear transformations are simultaneously diagonalizable. So just to give you a hint as to what it would look like if you were to do this in the case of level 11, let's just compute a couple of characteristic polynomials. So if you take T2 and compute its characteristic polynomial, you get that, which doesn't tell you very much, but if you factor it, you factor it, you get this. Yeah. X minus 3 times x plus 2 squared. Okay, well, maybe it isn't that hard. But in general, you can't really see very much. Okay, you do have a point that it's pretty clear that 3 the first vector is an eigenvector with... by the way, this is acting from the right.
So you do T3 dot matrix.
Sounds too cool. But the... what?
T3 dot matrix. I just think that would be 4.
I think you are right. Indeed, it's 4. So you can, and in fact, if you factor the Kerr poly, as you say, let's see, FCP is just a shorthand for a factored characteristic polynomial. Let's see if there's a 4. And indeed, if you look at any of these T sub P, you'll find that there's one eigenvalue equal to P plus 1. Except for p equals 11, where that's not true. But for all their p, there's one eigenvalue equal to p plus 1. This, in fact, corresponds to a weight 2 level 11 Eisenstein series. And its Q expansion has coefficients, the sum of the divisors of p. And the only interesting thing is really what happens in the constant coefficient and the linear coefficient, I guess. Oh, the constant coefficient. but there is a weight to Eisenstein series that is equal to something plus Q plus some, well, plus some sigma sub K minus 1, K is 2, so sigma sub 1, sum of the divisors N, Q to the N, at least for N coprime to 11. And I'm not sure exactly at the moment what happens for N equal to 11, or divisible by 11. But anyways, this is just reflecting the fact that there is a weight to Eisenstein series. So the really interesting part is over here, though. This corresponds, this other quadratic factor that we have in each case, corresponds to the cuspidal subspace of M2 gamma 0 N. So let me let S be M dot cuspidal submodule. Okay, it's a dimension 2 submodule, and for each prime, or in fact each integer, you have a matrix of the Heck operator acting on there. And notice that these are all scalar matrices. Now here's a fun thing you can do. Take this list of matrices, and I'll just take the upper left entry for P in the primes up to 100. Uh-oh, I can't see. Oh, the entries of the matrix are labeled 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. So just do this for the primes up to 100, and we get a list. And I made a typo. Yes, thank you very much. For P in, list of primes up to 100. And I can print that out, and I get a bunch of numbers. Now, the n here is 11. So if you consider the unique up to isogeny elliptic curve of conductor 11, which happens to be denoted by 11a in Cremona's tables, here's the curve, here's its conductor. You can do something similar, which is you can make w the number of, p plus 1 minus the number of points on our curve over the finite field fp, where p in the primes up to 100. Okay, so now we have two lists. We have V, and now we have W. And do you notice any relationship between the two lists? They're exactly identical. And the reason is because these numbers are the coefficients of a modular form, a cuspidal modular form of level 11 and weight 2.
Which is Weyl's theorem.
Yeah, or well, Shimura, I think, verified this long before that. But in general, it's Weyl's theorem that if you take any elliptic curve over Q, and compute these numbers, you get the coefficients of a cuspidal modular form. On the other hand, so that's these. On the other hand, the v's, these are the eigenvalues of the Heck operators acting on m2 gamma 0 of n, or at least on some factor of m2 gamma 0 of n. And this m2 gamma 0 of n is essentially, as a Hecke module, essentially isomorphic to modular forms of weight 2 for gamma 0 of n. So we're just computing an object that's isomorphic to an object that has to contain that system of eigenvalues. Okay, so I'm done for today. And two things. One, next week, what we're going to start with is a detailed, I'll just talk all about how to go from this to computing S2 gamma 0 of n explicitly. And the other thing I want to say is just that this method where you compute this space and then find an eigenvector in it and then write down the list of eigenvalues is most of what John Cremona does in his systematic enumeration of elliptic curves over Q. That's how you find elliptic curves. You can provably find all the elliptic curves this way. You just do the linear algebra to find this space M2 gamma 0 of n. Once you have that space, you find the rational eigenvectors in there. They correspond provably to the elliptic curves over Q up to isogeny of conductor n. And then by hook or crook, you try to find actual Weierstrass equations for those curves. And in fact, you can use modular symbols via properties of this pairing to efficiently, in many cases at least, compute the Weierstrass equations as well. Okay? So, and that's described in great detail in Cremona's book. Okay, so I'll talk about the final section of chapter 3 on Monday. Yes.
So if you were to evaluate the t squared and b squared, you just replace all these by t squared.
Yeah.
Is that true?